Accession number 1726, Mr. Thomas Lawton, reel 3.
Mr. Lawton, reel 3. During the First World War, Mr. Lawton, what became, or how desperate did the foot situation become?
Well, as a lad, I wouldn't really know. But you see, we must remember that probably our staple diet, outside of being jam and bread, was dripping and bread. We always did have a good Sunday's dinner. And it's not only during the time of war, but in later years, during the general strike and all that, you see, we always had a very poor diet, although we didn't think so. So jam and bread, dripping and bread was regular. A funny thing is that on a Sunday, we always had a very good dinner. And I think that's where the saying came from, a little basket is as good as a big garden, because every pitman had a garden or an allotment, and they were always generous, and you could always go and get a few taties out of them. So far as I'm concerned, I cannot really speak about what the food situation was, but it was obviously rationed. In other words, I never feel that in any way I was deprived of anything to eat during the First World War.
Did you have a hatred of the Germans during the war?
Yes, yes. Oh, yes. I hated the Germans during the First World War. I hated Hitler, away with Germany, when he came to power. And an interesting thing is, you see, that I took a very strong interest in the Black Shirt movement. And in actual fact, I travelled with the Black Shorts, up into Scotland, down to Hyde Park, hundreds of Black Shorts. Now I travelled with them, and I had a black short, and I had a black tie. But you see, when I left school in 1914, my father said to me, "Now remember, there's only one party for the working man, and that's the Labour Party." "Yes, Father." "And when you're old enough, you'll be a union man." "Yes, Father." And the father thought in my mind, I could never be a staunch Labour man. I could never be a staunch political man of any kind.
Since you've mentioned him, and we may as well deal with it now, what was the attraction for you of the Black Shirt movement?
The nationalism. The patriotism. You see, at that time, we were getting, in this part of the world, we were getting very much underweighted with labour, which they called socialism. And if you were a labour man or a socialist in this little village, go for a job if you're there. And to prove this, if you go to a certain part of Burton, you'll find every street is named after one of the Labour mans in Bourne, you see. Denison Terrace, Malone Gardens, Hunter Terrace. Right? So actually, socialism was getting towards communism. And although I was never politically minded, I did weigh these situations up. And I was in the territorials, and we were told not to wear uniform, even when we went for ammunition. For the shoot, of course, went in civvies with an officer. Eh? I have a little story about one man. I'll not repeat it, but he was a man. He was a pitman, lived next door to us. They called him Bob Clift. He had one daughter, and had a piano. Pitman always had pianos, and that she played the piano. When she got married, he never let her have that piano. That piano stood in Bob Cliff's home, although he couldn't play it. and she was married. And that was my opinion of what they called a socialist, where they say, why, socialist, you help each other, you give, see. So, I met a fella, he was a paper man, and I saw in his shop window, the black shirt, paper. So I went in, I says, Bob, what's that? Oh, he says, that's the black shirt, it's like fascist paper, you know. I says, fascist? Uh-huh. Of course, Hitler wasn't much gender. I said, are you not fighting to put that in your window? No. I says, you lose your trade, of course. He said, ah, and he did. He put that in the window. All the Labourites left him. And through Bob, I made inquiries, and I got to know that the Gateshead branch of the Black Shorts, they were going up to Dumfries. I says, I'll be travelling with him. He says, I can join. I says, no, I'd like to travel with him. I'd like to. I went with Dumfries. Drill hole at Dumfries, the biggest drill hole I've ever seen. And there was 1,000 free seats for the communists. It cost about, at the time, I think it cost about 50 bob or something to get in to hear Mosley speak. Right? And when I saw Mosley, I was fairly mad that. He was on a platform. I didn't know that we'd do the platform. There's about 100 heavy hitters, you know. And he went on, and he talked, my language. British Empire. Britain for the British, an empire self-supporting, dictatorial to the rest of the world. Oh, that's me. Fight and talk. Then we're told, no, when we leave here, keep together. Don't wander. You'll be lost sheep if you walk on your own. And as we came down to the railway station, there was half bricks, bottles and all kinds flung out from behind the lamps. We couldn't see them. See? So when we got on the train, it was like a casualty train. All my teeth were smashed. And oh, there was blokes there, the blood was running off them. And the fella come round, he says, right, pay attention. Looking for casualties. Right. Very good. Right. He says, name? I said, Lawton. Thomas Lawton. What branch are you with? I said, I'm not with any branch. You're not any branch? No, I said, I'm not a black shirt. I said, I'm just a traveller. Oh, I said, I'm sorry. Couldn't get a thing, eh? Went down to Hyde Park with them. Always remember the police escorting us down to Hyde Park and saying, you're funny people, huh? We've just taken their maids down there, the commies. So in Hyde Park, they had communists. And that's the first time I ever saw an autogyro helicopter, police. First one I ever saw, keeping control. Why, that was a punch-up. The result was, a lot of what you called me was the black shot. And I remember going on drills one night, and the PSI, the permanent staff instructor, said to me, Tom, I was a corporal. Are you a black shirt? I said, I'm not. Why do you ask that? Ah, well, because there aren't any black shirts in the British Army, you know. I said, who told you that? Eh? I said, who told you that? Right. I said, you don't know who's a black shirt and who isn't. I said, I'll prove you something to you. I'm going to take my tunic off. I took my tunic off, black shirt on. Oh, lad, he said. I said, hold on, it's the only shot I've got. But I saw Mosley turn up with jack boots on, a leather belt, and a nose, and a cap, big cap. Oh, I said, oh, that's not it. I had no intention, but I was very, very sympathetic towards the black shirt movement. And it was because of the socialism that was growing, you see. They were condemning everything, condemning the flag, they were condemning everything, saying that didn't suit me. Even as a kid, at school I used to walk around the floor in our house with a broom on my shoulder, marching to the gramophone, you know. I was always going to be a soldier. Never got to that. I became a terrier. But I did join up with the regular army at the finish. But the whole point is, yes, and it followed me into the prison camps. The first prison camp I went into, they called it Sommerlager. It was supposed to be a summer camp where we'd sleep in sheep pens, you see. We'd come from a hell camp called Schumann. And there was a chap out of the Wiltshire Regiment. He was a sergeant major. I wasn't officer class two, as soon as myself. He came to me one day, he says, "Tom, are you a black shirt?" I says, "Oh, why?" Well, he said, "I walked over in the car tie." That was the office, you know. And he says, "In the car tie, somebody had been on about black shorts." And they said, "Somebody, there's no black shorts in the British Army." And one German officer said, "There are. There's one in this camp." "What? There's a black shirt in this camp. The red-headed sergeant major is a black shirt." Eh? I said to Fred Ted Turvey, "It's impossible." I said, "There was a black shirt." I was sympathetic. I found out later, a bloke from Burtley called Kit Moore. It's not a simple lad, but one of these quiet books. He was very friendly with a German called Mr. Prince. "Why, he's a nice man, that Mr. Prince, Tom." I says, "He's only trying to find out stuff from you, Ken. Don't trust him." "Aye. I put two and two together. Kit Moore. Mr. Prince, I've got this out of me, any back shots." "Aye." With the result that it became in my favour eventually. The best friend I ever had was a German Hauptmann called Hauptmann Plater. He was a Gestapo man in uniform. And 6,000 Frenchmen knew that. And there were only 3 Englishmen among 6,000 Frenchmen. And they warned us against him. He turned out to be the best friend I ever had.
Can we come back to that later, because we will be reaching that.
No, I'm jumping.
No problem. Can we go back now? You finished your school life and you've started work at the pit.
Yes.
And I think you said you're 14?
Eh?
How old were you?
14.
What was your first job?
My first job was apprentice joiner at a colliery. An apprentice joiner meant from the age of 14 I would serve my time. When I was 21, I would be classed as a joiner, or as they called them then, a mechanic, because all trades at the colony were mechanics. Right? So I stuck it for about, I would rather be in the blacksmith shop than the joiner shop. I stuck it for about 18 months. And I told my father, I says, "Father, I wish I could make more money." "More money?" He said, "I'll get you a job, a man's job, a man's money. But you'll have to say that you're 18 at least." Well, you see, I was only 17. And he got me a job, what they called ballast filling at a pit, filling ballast into wagons. From then, I moved into the fire holes, the boilers. And I was a fireman for about 3 years. And then, of course, things were getting bad. I got a ride from here. I sat on a sack of straw from Burtley to King's Cross Station, nearly 300 miles. Sat on a sack of straw in the back of a wagon. I slept overnight in the Roughton House, 1 shilling for a bed in the Roughton House. And next day I thumbed a lift, hitchhiked 33 miles to Dagenham to get a job in Ford's. And I dug holes in the road for 6 months around London until I got into Ford's. And I got into Ford's. About 1934, and I got a job receiving and checking. I was receiving parts of machines, you know, and checking them. It was a good job, but working at Ford's, of course, you kept at it. You're good. I managed to get a house. I brought my wife and 2 daughters down into Dagenham, buying a nice little house on what they call the Rylands Estate. Champion, go out to work there regular, coming home, The kids went to school down in Dagenham. And then what happened? August 1939, I get word report back to base. And I reported back up here in the August to be held as a key man for the new battalion.
What age were you when you got married?
When I got married, I was 25 years of age. And I married a lass called Lena McMahon, who was a school teacher. She was a Catholic, I wasn't. But I had no qualms about all that. We got married in the Catholic Church, right behind you. And I'll never forget the priest, Father Malarkey. Russian name, Father Malarkey. When we walked from the altar to go in to sign the register, he says, "Just a minute. My wife was Martina, but we always called her Ina." That's a photograph there. "Ina, I'm going to give you some sound advice." And he looked at me, and although he says, "Tom, I hope you don't mind what I'm going to say." I had a clue what he's going to say. I nearly said, "What are you going to say?" "Ina, never mention religion to this man." He says, "All right, Tom." He says, "I've met a lot of men in my time." He says, "But if by being a good wife and a good mother, you can make him think there's something in the religion, that's your duty." I turned Catholic when I was 8 years old. And I mean, I used to go there with a wife when we caught, married across there, all the family were Catholics. I learned later that my father were all born and was Catholics and left the church. I've told the priest across there, he says, "What?" I says, "Father Malarkey told my wife never to mention religion to me. And since becoming a Catholic, I've been across there. I've even spoken about the Bible to them. Because the Catholics didn't agree a lot about the Bible." That's not jocular, because they never were taught it. But got on very well. They never ruled it. And all my family were baptized or christened as Catholics. One side of the family, inner side, kept it up. The other side, that's all them there in that little photograph, there were nine of them. They never kept it up. And only one of them got married in the Catholic Church. But makes no difference. And Burnley, I think, is one place where Northern Ireland should get a grip on itself. Here in Burnley, never has there been less than 25 to 30% of the population Roman Catholics. And there's never been any trouble. In fact, I've known men standing, watching the old priest that used to be here, in case he got knocked down, because he used to dodder a bit. I've seen men, pitmen, one Catholic, watching the old priest say, "He'll get knocked down one of these times, and they'll be in there like a shot." Right? But there's never been any trouble, religious-wise, and the Catholic men's choir have a concert party which goes down to the different chapels to give charity concerts, never charge a penny. And so I was 25 years of age when I got married. I had two daughters. One died about 13 years ago. The other one is still alive. She is now retired. She was a school teacher. And an interesting thing, I have a granddaughter, that lass at the top yonder, teaches at Amble. And my wife used to teach in Amble when I was courting her. And I used to go on a bicycle to Amble, you know, to see her and come back again. And so, you know, it makes you think that somehow a thing is planned. And it goes round, and if you live long enough, you come to that period. And a short while ago, I was introduced to a new bishop of Newcastle who likes to be called Father... Yeah, I forget now. He doesn't like to be called Bishop, right? Or My Lord. And I was introduced to him, and when we were talking, he got on about various things, about where was I born, etc. And I said, "Do you know, Father, I've now completed a circle, right round the Far East and Canada and everything, and I'm back now," and I said, "I've got me fare for my one-way passage fair, Papa? I says, I was going to say, up the chimney. Do you know what he says? To heaven. And you say, I'm so touchy. You see, anybody said to me, to heaven, I would say, hey, hold on, hold on. But you see, this bishop, nice chap, and he's talked to me. And what I said, the thing is, no, Father, I've completed the circle in life. I'm within 100 or 200 yards of where I was born 90 years ago. And I said, I've got to be fair for that last one-way journey. Ah, and they look at me as if to say, and I says, and I went up the chimney because the crematorium is just down there, see. And I says, and before I could see up the chimney, he says, up to heaven.
What made you join the territorials?
Oh, I wanted to go to camp. You see, there were no holidays, paid or unpaid, in those days. And men joined the territorials to get 2 weeks away at camp with army pay, be about 1 or 9 a day, right? And 14 days in the fresh air. Well, it was wonderful. And in 1922, I joined the territorials. I wasn't 16 years old. And I've got a photograph of there with someone being it like that, all it did, rifling bayonets, you know. And I joined the territorials, and I was playing marbles when a bloke comes and says, hey, you're supposed to be up there drilling, you know. Hey, I was 15 and a half, 16, but I joined as 18.
Can you take me into the process of joining the territorials?
Yes, at that time. Right. There was a chap who used to come up Harris Bank, very dapper chap, in uniform, good little chap. And he once stopped me and he said, what do they call you? I says, Lawton. There you are. He gives a penny. He says, I always see you very smart, very clean and very tidy. And he gives a penny. Hey, well, my brother was the territorials. So I'll go and join the terriers. How do you join the terriers? Go along to the drill hall. Known as the armory at one time, then converted to drill hall. See, B company was half company, Chester half and Burley half. So I go along. I want to join the territorials. Oh, come in. Sergeant, and there's an officer sitting there. Don't remember. How old are you? 18, sir. Mm-hmm. You live in Berkeley? Oh, yes, I just lived down there. Have you any relatives? I said, no, my brother was in the territorial, and I says, a lot of my friends are territorials. Aha. Uh-huh. A lot of questions asked, but in a nice atmosphere. Well, I'll tell you what. Come back, we'll say, next Thursday, and we'll take in the territories, and you'll sign the attestation papers, and so forth and forthwith. Good. And I went back, and I signed the papers, and I, you know, where you swear to allegiance to the king, and that's it. But there was one thing that struck me. Territorial army, what's the difference between the territorial and the regular? See? And I always remember asking this officer, I knew what to say, so, like, by the way, sir, why do they call it territorial army? Eh? You know, he never struck him. I said, why, it's not the regular army, is it? He said, oh, no. Well, no. The bugger, I wish I'd never mentioned. He started telling me how they formed the volunteers during the Napoleonic Wars, you know. And from that, of course, came the Durham Volunteers. Now we have the Durham Light Infantry Territorial Army. And the Territorial Army is there as a defence force against any attempted invasion from outside. Territorial? Ah, territorial, of course. And it was as simple as that. And within a short time, I was a lance corporal.
Did you get a uniform immediately?
Oh, within a week.
What uniform did you get?
Well, it was obviously a uniform that somebody had thrown away in the trenches during the war. The jacket was almost green rather than khaki. It was short, very short. The trousers They were either one thing or another. The boots I got, I took a size 8, and the second year I took a size 9, the third year I got a pair of 10s, and I turned round to them. The first hat I got, when I give eyes right, the hat stayed in the same position. It was too big, you know. But there was never a smarter soldier than me, even with my little green pea jacket and my trousers and my putties. I should put them on so tight to look smart that I'm sure I developed varicose veins from them. Eh?
How did you put them on?
Oh, you have a roll of putty, right? And you start with the end. No, the end with this putty goes from the top, there. The horse soldier put his putty from the bottom up. But the infantryman, and start from the inside. And you wrap it round outward. Outward, 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 right down to your boots. And when you got to your boots, there was a tape about that long, and you fastened the putty by wrapping that tape round and put the neat loop in it. Ah. But you see, you were supposed to put so many turns on, and so much apart, right? And your trousers, the one box pleated, they just tucked into the putty. More like bloomers. And that was one of the difficult things, putting a pair, some blokes wore two pair putties to give them a nice shaped leg. I put mine on so tight I could hardly walk. But there was another thing where I could have been instructed in that. But you see, even your equipment, you got some equipment. You got a blackboard.
What did they give you in equipment?
Pouches. The pouches, you know, about, I think it was 3 and 2, about 5 pouches each side there for the cartridges, right? Your belt, and your bayonet frog, and your haversack to go to one side, your water bottle for to go to the other side, and your valise, as they called it, or we called it the big pack, became known as Jerry Wooten Up, because Jerry Wooten was a jockey. And he says, Jerry Wooten's up. That was the pack on your back. And must get blankoed. With the result that one fella came up, all white blankoed. So old blanko he knew, he never used a green blanko or khaki. But as we got more used to the thing, we said, we take the thing apart. Nobody ever showed us how to strip the thing down and do them strap by strap. We tried to do the lot together, see. So we must have been really a Fred Karno's army when we turned out, but we didn't think so.
When did you get issued with a rifle?
Oh, within 2 or 3 nights.
And you kept that rifle?
Yes.
What rifle was it?
It was a Shortley Enfield. It was just after Lee Metford had gone. And we had the same Shortley Enfields when we went to France in 1940. And we had the same long bayonet. And we'd get me long bayonet on, and me rifle. A bit heavy for us at first, like. The fixing of bayonets. Interesting thing. There's a cenotaph down there in Burtley. It was opened up or unveiled in 1923. And I was the right-hand corporal of the ceremonial firing party. What? 1920? Yes, 73 years ago. There was a woman says, you couldn't be, Tommy. I said, I was, man. I'm telling you. I said, I can tell you the sergeant in charge of the party, Sergeant Martin Henderson, Chester Street. The left-hand corporal, Corporal George Welsh from Houston. Can't tell you the names of the men. Right-hand corporal, Corporal Thomas Lawton, Burtley. And the precautionary word for the fixing of bayonets was, the party will fix bayonets. On the word fix, you don't fix. The right-hand man will take 3 smart paces forward and give the time for the fix of bayonets by turning the head to the left while the rest of the party turns the head to the right. On the word fix, you don't fix. And I tell folks, I say, I never, I say, oh yes, I say, I know, man. And when I pass that thing, The bloke says, do you get on parade regular, Tommy? They'll sell it off? No. I was on parade once. Where? The cenotaph. When? I says, when they open it up. But I says, every day, every Amherst day, I go down there to criticise the parade, you know, with all the medals on.